So Brooke and I went to a church planting conference early this week. Got to be there Monday and Tuesday at a church called Antioch Community Church down in Texas, in Waco. They have done an extraordinary job planting churches all over the world. 186 teams they've sent out in the last 10 years to every place on the planet you can't even imagine. And so we wanted to go down there because we are right on the cusp of starting to develop our own church planting strategies on allowing us to become the kind of church that does that. And so I wanted to go and visit with them, and they had a little conference going on, so Brooke and I went down there. It's always fun to get out of your environment into another environment, especially when that environment is a spiritual environment where people love Jesus and you can just tell, and it's just awesome. And so we go there, and that's exactly what it was like. I mean, this church, they love God so much, and you can just feel it, and you've got none of the normal worries and stuff going on. And so for 2 days, you just soak it in, you know, and it was awesome. So Brooke and I, we were inspired, we're excited, we're coming home, we're like, you know what, we're going to spend more time with Jesus, that's it, we can't survive without it, we're reminded of all of that, and we get home and it's just exciting, and we pull in the driveway and it's exciting, and we go in the door and there's four children waiting for us and they're all small, and that too is exciting, but in a whole different kind of a way. And it was amazing to watch this week unfold. It has to be one of the bad weeks that go down in history for us. It just starting right coming in the door, you know, our kids, things started unraveling real early on. You know, Wednesday hit and things weren't so good. And Brooke and I were kind of tense with each other about some stuff. And then Wednesday unfolded badly and went into Wednesday night. The kids were crazy. And Thursday was definitely no better whatsoever. So we got back Thursday night. We came to the for better or worse class, marriage class, and we sat with our for better or worse folks, and we said, hey, we just want to tell you we've had a bad week, and it's been really rough. And we talked it through, and we felt better about things, and we thought, this is good. This is the breakthrough. This is why we have these moments with each other. And we got home Thursday night, and it got worse, and it was awesome. And Friday was really bad, and, you know, we're going through Friday, and we hit Saturday. This was my daughter's my daughter's birthday week, so Saturday's her birthday party. We're just trying to muster up the strength to pretend to be happy on Saturday. And have you ever been there? Have you ever been there? You come off this incredible weekend, you're so challenged, and then the whole thing unravels, and there's nothing left at the end of it, and you don't know what happened. You know, this whole week I've been working and studying and researching the stuff we're about to get into. I get to Saturday, and, you know, thank God, I'm so grateful to Him that He speaks to us whether we're being good or bad. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, if God stopped speaking to me every time I messed up, you guys would never get anything on a Sunday. So I'm just glad that God keeps doing that. And so I'm studying and I'm working, and here I am in Scripture working on this story. I get to Saturday and I'm, God, what are you trying to tell us? What is it you want us to tell the people? I mean, what is it you want to speak to Mosaic Church? And on Saturday, it's like God went Saturday night, even last night. You know, Brooke's at Bunko, and I'm sitting working. I was like, God, I just don't quite get what you're trying to say here. And God whispers and goes, look around right now. Look at your house. I mean, does this feel familiar to you? And suddenly, boom, just like that, it clicks. And I realize the story that I'm reading, studying all week long is my house. It's my house. And God went, tell them that. And I went, all right, let me show you what I mean. We're going to turn to the book of 1 Kings. Grab your Bibles. If you don't have a Bible, under the chairs there's a bunch of Bibles. Grab one of those. We're going to go to 1 Kings because we are in 1 Kings as we travel through the journey, Genesis to Revelation, chronologically. And we've just finished the story of Solomon in 1 Kings. And don't forget that in 2 Chronicles chapter 10, remember that 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles track together. So they tell the same story, but different details. It's important because there's some things I'm going to talk about today as we're dealing with 1 Kings that are actually in 2 Chronicles chapter 10. You're welcome to read that later on. But you'll see 2 Chronicles chapter 10 and 1 Kings chapter 12 start in exactly the same place, okay? We're going to be in 1 Kings. So go to 1 Kings page 243 of our Bibles if you have one of those. In 1 Kings chapter 12, there is an interesting scenario playing out here that we'll get to in a second, but let me just paint a picture for you on what's going on here. Solomon has been king of Israel, a united kingdom, all of the 12 tribes together. Remember that the kingdom was really have some really tough times during the Judges. Then during Saul's time, although they were technically united, that was just a technicality. They were bickering, and there was always the northern tribes and the southern tribes. Judah was kind of David's area, and all of Ephraim and all of Israel was kind of Saul's area. And it, even though it wasn't in word that way, in perception from the outside world, that's what they perceived. And then we walked into David's time, and he brought those two together, remember that? And Solomon unites the kingdom like never before around a vision and a movement that is incredible. And then Solomon unravels toward the end, gets into all sorts of stuff he shouldn't, forgets about the vision, and the entire nation unravels around him. And it is in that place that we jump into the story. Just before we get to chapter 12, one thing you need to know, there is a guy in the story, Jeroboam, who was a man that was really smart, really cool, really a guy that was behind Solomon. And Solomon put him in charge of a lot of stuff. And then there was a prophecy given where a prophet came to him and said, you are going to ultimately tear apart some of the tribes and you're going to rule a section of the tribes. And word got out about the prophecy. And what happens when a prophecy is made about you ruling the current kingdom? Bad news. So he heads off, flees to Egypt, where he takes asylum in Egypt under one of the pharaohs there and becomes friends with the Egyptians. You need to know that for later on in the story. So let's jump back into chapter 12 now. One of Solomon's sons is about to jump in and become king. Rehoboam is his name. And Rehoboam, being one of the sons of Solomon, takes over the kingdom. Now, interesting things happen. And just so you know, I'm going to touch on a few things in the chapter here, but for the most part, I expect you to read 12, 13, and 14 yourself, either now or later on. I'm kind of going to be painting the story for you, so pay close attention. Rehoboam, as he becomes the new king, they are currently down in the southern part of the kingdom. There's a northern part and a southern part. The southern part is primarily Judah and Benjamin, those two tribes, and the northern part of the other 10 tribes. Jerusalem sits down in the southern section, and then, of course, the northern section, you've got that. Now, Rehoboam's down there. Generally speaking, when a new king comes about, Israel, the delegation from the northern part of the kingdom, comes down to Jerusalem, and they come and they do the whole inauguration. The southern kingdom, the northern kingdom, the delegation. Although they're united, they were just represented in these two parts because the northern kingdom was so spread out. So they come down, they inaugurate the new king, and everybody's happy. In this case, though, you'll notice in the chapter that Rehoboam had to go up to Shechem in the northern kingdom because the northern delegation didn't bother coming down to Jerusalem to come and inaugurate him king. What does that whisper to you? That should whisper to you there's already a problem brewing, and we will see it unfold. So Rehoboam goes up to the northern section, goes to Shechem, and guess who happens to be in Shechem? Jeroboam is there. So Rehoboam's gone up. Jeroboam is there. Jeroboam is the guy that had headed off to Egypt. He's come back now, and he's kind of head of the northern delegation. And when Rehoboam gets up there and he says, I want you guys to support me. I want you to be behind my kingship. This is what they tell him. They said to him, look, here's the deal. Under Solomon, the taxes were incredibly high. The labor was incredibly hard. There was a huge demand on our people to try to build this kingdom, and we want it to stop. So if you will stop all of that, then we will support you. And if you won't, then we won't. That was the conditions the northern kingdom gave Rehoboam. And they said to him, you got 3 days to go and talk about this and come back to us and tell us what you want to do. So Rehoboam goes back, and guess what he does? He surrounds himself with some of the delegation from his dad's time, some of the old boys. And they come around and they say this to him. They say, listen, here's the deal. This is the moment of leadership, man. Your dad was strong and he was powerful, and that's why people followed him. You got to get back up there in their faces and you got to tell them, you will not be demanding stuff from us. We are the ones that have the demands and you'll do what we say. As a leader, there is a time and a place where someone is pushing back on your leadership that you kind of have to step in and go, that's not appropriate. But there's also a time and a place where that's a really bad move. And in this case, we are in that time and place. Why? Because what Rehoboam didn't understand at this point is that all of the respect for the southern part of the kingdom had been lost. Solomon had unraveled everything toward the end. And instead of being united by an incredible vision and an incredible movement where paying the high price for that movement was no problem, it had become a problem. And when you've lost that kind of respect and that kind of leadership, you do not have the place to jump in and demand things. So Rehoboam goes back to them and he says, look, here's the deal. You think my dad taxed you badly? You just wait to see what I'm going to do. And you think my dad used you in a labor force? Just wait till you see how hard it's going to get next. You guys need to submit to my leadership. And you know what they tell him? What part do we have in the house of David? Go away. Go back to your silly little kingdom. We'll do our own thing up here. And boom, right there it happens. The 10 northern tribes established around Ephraim call themselves Israel, and the two southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, he goes back to Jerusalem, and they are under Rehoboam. So Rehoboam's down here, Jeroboam's up here, and they establish two kings in the kingdom. And once and for all, the kingdom is not only in word united and not really in deed, it is now in word broken and in deed. So technically speaking, they're not at all united, not even technically. They are broken into two kingdoms. The northern kingdom sits up top, the southern kingdom sits down at the bottom, and down goes Rehoboam back home. And now things start developing. Just so you know, this kind of stuff, you might look at this and go, whoa, that was fast. I mean, Solomon totally united and boom, this just happens. But it doesn't never just happens that way, does it? Back in the book of Judges, way back in the book of Judges, during the time of Gideon, do you remember Gideon? Gideon was the guy that had that fantastic victory over the other armies. Well, during that time, Gideon did not include Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, in that victory. And Ephraim was ticked about it. And they came and they complained and they said, how come you didn't include us? What's the deal? Understand this about Ephraim. It's kind of interesting. Judah is the largest tribe of the 12 tribes. Guess who the smallest tribe is? You'd guess Ephraim and you'd be wrong because I'm trying to trick you now. It's not Ephraim. They are the second smallest tribe. You know that second smallest. You know how those people are, right? They feel picked on all the time, but at least they got someone they can pick on. And they create a really neat attitude, don't they? So you've got Ephraim on the one hand, whose attitude is, we might be small, but we're powerful. And you've got Judah, whose attitude is, we're the biggest, be quiet. And there you see the split, even in Gideon's time, begin to develop. Then after Gideon's time, as the judges unfold, it was Ephraim that kept coming back and complaining that they weren't included, that they weren't part of things, and you see the seed start developing. Then in Saul's time, it was Ephraim and Judah that were constantly at each other's throats. During Saul's time, it was Judah was David, Israel or Ephraim was Saul. And then it was only under David and Solomon that they could bridge that gap and create the unity. And you know what happened when the unity was created? Splendor, fantastic wonder in the kingdom. That's what happened. And here we are, and we're right back where we started with the two kingdoms splitting apart. So you know what happens next? You would think that Judah, the largest tribe in the southern kingdom, would hold all the power and all the wealth and all the money and all the strength because they had the larger armies, they had the larger tribe, and they had wealth. What wealth did they have? Anybody guess? Solomon's wealth. Remember, Jerusalem sits in the southern part of the kingdom. And who built the temple in Jerusalem? Who built the palace? Who collected more wealth than we could possibly know? It was Solomon. And who held all of that wealth? Rehoboam did in the southern kingdom. Not only that, but because of their strength, you would think that in time they would be the stronger of the two parts. But there is some things that started developing that weakened the southern tribes and basically caused them to be in submission for the rest of the time. First of all, from a land perspective, they were landlocked in many ways. To their east was the Dead Sea. To their south was the Negev, and to their west was the Gaza Strip and the Philistines. The only opening they had to have any real influence on the planet and any real effect in terms of trade and all that was to the north. And guess who sat to the north? Their brothers, Israel. So yes, that made a lot of sense. You had a complete openness unless there was a break there and the northern kingdom started cutting them off. And that's exactly what the northern kingdom began to do. cut off their northern route, and then they started developing, and here's what happened. As developments started, first, Jeroboam, coming out of Egypt and coming out of being under the Pharaoh there, he decides, we do not want the 10 tribes, and you'll see this now happening, we'll touch on it in a second. He decides, he doesn't want the 10 tribes to start feeling sorry again for the southern kingdom. So, where do the people worship right now? Down in Jerusalem. So guess what he does? He says, guys, I know it's such a long way to go down to Jerusalem. We're going to go ahead and worship up here. Look at this. In chapter 12 in verse 28, you can take a look at this. After seeking advice, the king made two golden calves. He said to the people, this is Jeroboam, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. One he set up in Bethel and the other in Dan. And this thing became a sin and the people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there. See what's happened here? Jeroboam's been in Egypt for a while. What does Egypt do? They set up golden stuff, right? So now we've got it. He's coming out of Egypt. He's become friends with Egypt. It's all cool. He sets up two golden calves and he says to them, You go and worship here at these two places. Do not go back down to the temple. He sets up priests and he sets up a whole little separate world in the northern kingdom. Sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? So that starts happening there. In the meantime, he begins to fight with the southern kingdom. And they become to that northern border and they begin to battle and fight there. And so you know what that forces the southern kingdom to do? Take all of their resources, all of their energy, and build all of their fortresses where? On their border. In the northern part of the kingdom. Isn't this fantastic? You've got nations around you who can sniff out Solomon's treasure, and you are building all of your fortresses on the northern kingdom between you and your brothers. Fantastic, isn't it? And while you're doing that, spending your resources, spending your energy, spending your armies, spending your fortresses up in the northern kingdom, what do you think that that does to the rest of your kingdom? Starts weakening everywhere. So you've got a kingdom, Israel, that united, was so full of splendor that people traveled from all over the world to come and gain wisdom and to come and discover the wonder of the God that they serve and to come and see what kind of a little nation can blossom into something so extraordinary. And now, just a generation later, you've got that same United Kingdom split into two, battling at each other's fronts, whittling down all of the power they had so that they become so weak that the nations around them laugh at them. So much so that it didn't just stop there. At a certain point, the Pharaoh of Egypt looked at this scenario and said, wait a second, these people are so busy at the northern borders. I could walk right on in, take whatever I want. It was just before that began to happen that things started unfolding for Rehoboam as well. Take a look at chapter 14 in verse 22. As the battle is going on the northern front, all their fortresses are built there, everything's working, they're fighting their brothers. When that starts happening, very quickly, any real heart for God starts dissipating, doesn't it? And all that becomes a focal point is what's going on here. And look at this, verse 22, Judah did evil in the eyes of the Lord. By the sins they committed, they stirred up his jealous anger more than their fathers had done. They also set up for themselves high places, sacred stones, and Asher poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. So watch. You've got the northern kingdom setting up golden calves. You've got the southern kingdom setting up high places. You've got the whole thing unraveling. And you've got the two of them fighting each other right in the middle, leaving themselves vulnerable. And then look what happens. In verse 25, right there of chapter 14, 1 Kings. In the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem. Now, just to give you a quick idea, first of all, this is the Pharaoh that Jeroboam had gone and sought shelter from. These two guys are friends. You with me? Not only are they friends, but this particular Pharaoh, when it says he attacked Jerusalem, that is code word, or rather short sentence for a much bigger story. The much bigger story is, how do you get to Jerusalem? Well, you have to conquer all the way through the southern kingdom, all the way to the northern part where Jerusalem is. If they were at the gates of Jerusalem, attacking Jerusalem, that meant that they have conquered most of the southern kingdom. So you have an Egyptian pharaoh who has come in and has demolished most of the southern kingdom. He gets to Jerusalem, and we find out that he doesn't destroy Jerusalem, but listen to what happens. Again, here it says in verse 26, he carried off the treasures of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including all the gold shields Solomon had made. So King Rehoboam made bronze shields to replace them and assigned these to the commanders of the guard on duty at the entrance of the royal palace. It is almost a perfect picture of the splendor of a nation being stolen away, isn't it? You got the gold shields around the temple and around the palace with all the guards. You got all the riches and the gold and the splendor. From a distance, it must have been a fantastic sight of strength and honor and splendor. And in one fell swoop, it's all gone. And what you got left is a little bronze shield going, oh, thank you. And there you are. And you know what happened? What probably happened here as we look at historical situations is that Rehoboam looked at the situation and said, he's going to take Jerusalem and everything with it. And he went to him and said, I'll tell you what, we'll give you everything if you just leave us alone. And that's exactly what he did. He took everything and went back to Egypt. And Jerusalem was left alone, left with what? Nothing. So you see what's happening? Judah, who was the most powerful tribe, Judah and Benjamin together, powerful, are landlocked on all sides except north, and their brothers landlock them there, and they fight there, and then all that made them powerful is taken from the south when the Egyptians come in and steal it away. And there they are. And for the rest of the history, they will stand in that position for all intent and purposes. You know what happens next? You ready for this? That same Pharaoh looks at the scenario and goes, huh, interesting. It was so easy to take the southern kingdoms, I bet we could take the northern ones too. And he goes up and he fights Jeroboam. Now, can you imagine Jeroboam, the friend of the Pharaoh? And suddenly the Pharaoh is right there fighting him. And he goes in and he conquers a large part of the northern kingdom. But then some stuff happens in Egypt that has to draw him back, and he never completes the conquest. But he does some serious damage. And Jeroboam sat there with his head spinning. And here we have an incredible scenario of a king, a pharaoh in Egypt, where the people used to be slaves. Egypt used to be their enemy. And in Solomon's time and David's time, Israel had become so powerful that the Egyptians aren't even part of the story anymore. Isn't that amazing? And now those same Egyptians are back with a vengeance because the nation of Israel is weak on every front because they've spent themselves on fighting each other. And there it was. There it started dawning on me. Boy, nothing's changed, has it? Nothing's changed. I thought about the church. Not our church alone, but the church. In the book of Acts, there's a story of the church coming together for the first time, and it said thousands were added to their number daily. People traveled from all over the known world to come and see what this movement was all about, to come and find out what kind of life and vibrance existed there. When the Holy Spirit came and Jesus was vibrant in the lives of the people and everything was fresh and they gave themselves away for the sake of each other and their rights meant nothing, only the rights of the others. And it was this place of wonder where they broke bread together in their homes and they spent themselves for each other. They had the same mind, the same vision, the same unity, and it was powerful. And these words out of Matthew chapter 12 popped into my head where Jesus is in a situation and he's just cast some demons out of this person, and the Pharisees come and say to him, oh, he's just casting them out in the name of the devil. And Jesus looks at the Pharisees and says, listen, a kingdom divided against itself will be ruined, and a household divided against itself will fall. And that verse pops in my mind, and I think about the church today. Anybody want to get up and name the amount of denominations we have? I dare you. You won't be able to do it. There's too many. And that's if you stick with denominations. If you start taking any individual denomination and you break those down, boy, there's a whole nother list you can come up with. And then, of course, within those denominations, there are those churches in those denominations that only stay together as long as they agree. And when they stop agreeing, then they split apart and they do church planting. It's a whole nother version of church planting. We plant churches because we get ticked with each other and then we leave. That is not church planting. That is church splitting. And it does not create healthy church plants. You know, if you walked out on the street today and you said to people, hey, what do you think about the church, man? Do you think the church is powerful? Do you think that they're vibrant and alive? Is it a place you want to go? You can't wait until Sunday? Do you feel like when stuff's going bad, that that's the place you can run to? Do you think that when you're in need, those are the people that'll care for you? You think when you're messing up and you're failing, that those are the people that will stand by you and lift you up? And they'll go, I'm sorry, what are you talking about? Because I could line up the opposite of that list for the church. The church has lost all of its power, all of its vibrance, all of its life that was supposed to be the splendor to the world. Oh, but let's not stop there. That's the easy one, isn't it? Jesus also said, a household turned against itself will fall. You know, yesterday was my daughter's 9th birthday party, and I have her permission to share the story, so just so you know, I asked her this morning, and she said, sure. At the end of the birthday party, you know, these last 2 weeks, my kids have been out of control in a number of different ways. It's unusual, you know, but just hypothetically, anyways. They've been out of control, and Hadley in particular, 9 years old, she just turned 9 this week. She's in that mode right now. Well, you know, nine-year-olds, they talk back to their parents and they assert themselves and all that. That's fairly normal, not totally desirable, but fairly normal. And but it seemed to have unraveled bigger than that, to the point that yesterday at her birthday party, we're at the end of the birthday party, we're playing out back, and the kids are kind of slowly starting to go home, and there was a little incident that occurred between Hadley and I. It wasn't a perfectly good incident, okay? And it kind of, you know, she wanted something, and I wouldn't give it to her, and she got kind of mad, and it was a gift, and it was going to be open, and so I said, fine, you want to learn a lesson, watch this, and I opened the gift for her. Now she can't return it, now she has 3 of them, and I took it to her, and I said, here, and then she switched on me and went, I didn't want you to open it, and right there in front of all of her friends, she starts having a huge argument with her father. As a 9-year-old, that's not a smart idea. It's kind of Rehoboam going, you'll listen to me, and you go, oh, not good. So at her birthday party, I take her hand and I go, honey, you and me are going to have to go and talk. And we start walking and she starts screaming, I want to stay with my friends. And I'm like, we are walking and the neighbors are coming out. I'm not even kidding. Neighbors walking out on her patio just going, there's a kid screaming on the golf course. Oh, the dad's got her. Oh, should I call someone? I don't know. And we go inside to my house. We go up to her room. She is losing it. And I sit down with her, and I try to communicate with her, and she is so hysterical. She's screaming at me, and I said to her, look, till you're done screaming, we're done talking, and I left the room. And I heard her in her room screaming at the top of her lungs, and I went downstairs, and all the friends are like, bye, is Hadley around? I'm like, really sorry, I can't bring her down right now. And as all of that unfolds, as all of that happens, I finally go upstairs and Hadley calms down and I walk upstairs. It was such a beautiful picture. I get to outside of her door and I hear her screaming inside and the screams have changed. They've changed from, I'm ready, to this, I'm so disappointed in myself. I'm so sorry I've done this. I mean, she's screaming at the top of her lungs in her room, right? And I'm like, God. And you could tell, she didn't even know I was listening. It wasn't manipulation. It was just her kind of discovering. So I walk in there, and we sit together, and we cry together, and we talk together. And I sat with Hadley, and I said, honey, do you know that God has an enemy? Do you know that? And that God's enemy wants to steal, kill, and destroy everything you are. He doesn't want you to obey your parents. He doesn't want you to love people. He doesn't want you to be kind. He doesn't want you to be sweet. He doesn't want you to be selfless. He doesn't want you to take care of others. He doesn't want you to put others ahead of yourself. He wants you to think about you and your rights and what's yours. And when he does that, and he whispers into your ear and he says, Hadley, don't listen to those crazy parents of yours. They don't know what they're talking about. This is your stuff. Then you start acting like that. And you know who ends up losing? First you. And then all the rest of us. And right there, guys, like an audible voice, God goes, tell her about you. Tell her about what you did this week. And I'm like, she's 9, God. She doesn't need to hear that kind of stuff. And God goes, tell her. Tell her about what the enemy whispered to you and how well you listened to him. But not like a condemning father, just like kind of that smile, like going, this ain't just about a 9-year-old, Renaud. So I said to Hadley, I said, you know what, Hadley? Have your mom and I been talking nice to each other these last few days? Mm-mm. Has dad been kind to mom? Mm-mm. Have we been tense with each other? Mm-hmm. Has dad said anything this week that has built mom up? Mm-mm. I said, you know what, honey? You're not the only one that has the enemy whispering to you. He whispers to me. And he says, hey, you don't need to love her. You don't need to agree with her. You definitely don't need to meet her needs. Have you seen what she's been doing lately? Does it look like she cares about you? Listen, she's the enemy. You set up your fortresses as fast as you can. Get defensive, get mean, get ugly, because otherwise she's going to invade your space. And before you know it, you're the southern kingdom and she's the northern kingdom, and you spend all of your energy in between, don't you? And you know what? It's funny until your household starts dying. It's funny until the enemy sitting in the corner goes, they're so weak right now, I could take everything. My kids are not unraveling because they're 9 or 6. They're unraveling because Brooke and I are unraveling. And if we can't stop unraveling, they will not stop unraveling. I do not have the option to be anything but unified in my home with my wife. I do not have the option. It is critical. Because without that unity, we die. And along with us goes the household. And if the household goes, well, then goes the church. And if the church goes, well, then goes the world. We, Brooke and I, are the hope of this church, just like you and your wives and husbands are, just like you and your relationship, because we are the church. And the church is the hope of the world. When we love each other the way we ought to and we're unified, then we become splendor to the world. And they want to know what's going on. And when we stop that, we die. We lose our splendor. And we have bronze little shields going, we'll fight you. And nobody wants any part of it. So let me say this. Unity has to take a place above rights that you have, above needs that you have, above grievances that you have, above hurts that you have. We need to work on those things, but only inside of unity. If unity takes a second place to that stuff, like it always does, then we die and we lose our splendor. God puts it this way in the New Testament. In the book of Philippians, this will sound awful familiar to you since we've memorized this as a church. You have any idea why I had you guys memorize this particular verse? How many times have I come back to it in the last 6 months? 62,000? Here we go. Philippians chapter 2. If you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any fellowship with the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, and that should be a no-brainer for us Christ followers, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. I looked at Hadley last night and I said to her, honey, let's make a deal. I'll build mom up every day this week and you obey your parents every day this week, and we work together so we can look our enemy in the eyes and say, you have no place here, because we're not fighting each other. We're fighting you. And last night I had to sit with my wife and say, honey, I'm so sorry that this week I haven't built you up and I haven't spoken into your life and I haven't done anything that I was supposed to do. I'm so sorry we haven't been united. I'm so sorry we haven't had the same vision. I'm so sorry I failed you. but I will not do it again this next week. If I open my mouth, it will be to build you up, and if I speak, it will be in unity. And if I can't do either of those things, I'll keep my mouth shut. And I'm committed to that. Why? Because unity is not optional. It's critical. And it is what brings splendor into our home and into our church and eventually to the world. May we not be divided, but may we fight the one we're called to fight and not each other. Set your rights aside in your marriages, in your churches, in your relationships for the sake of someone else's rights. Speak only what builds them up and speak only into their life, not about their life. And we will change the world forever as Solomon did in his time. Let's pray. God, thank you for these two men and these two stories. God, I'm sorry for them that they were blinded enough not to wake up to this scenario. God, I'm honored that I can stand here and know that it is because of their stories that we get to live differently. May we not waste the lives that they've spent in failure to show us what success looks like. May we not waste the stories you've given us in your word to show us what freedom looks like. May we live instead in obedience to your word, knowing that obedience leads to freedom and freedom to life. And God, may we live it uncompromising. May we stand in our marriages, in our parenting, in our child-to-parent relationships, in our friendships, in our church family, and may we set unity as a higher standard than my personal rights are. And may we stand firm, unified, fighting the right enemy. May we never set fortresses up between each other's borders, and in so doing, weaken ourselves. But may we live in splendor and change the world while doing it. Help us to serve the world as we love you and we love people. We love you, Jesus.